Carla Wills, Laura Gattis, Dina Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Nermeen Sheikh, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Karen. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us. Our website is democracynow.org.
Cable Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 33rd Real Music Film Festival running through February 8th. Thursday, January 28th, will screen Landfill Harmonic. Landfill Harmonic follows the Recycled Orchestra of Keitora, a Paraguayan musical group that plays instruments made entirely out of garbage. When their story goes viral, the orchestra is suddenly catapulted into the global spotlight. This 2014 film has been described as a testament to the transformative power of music and the resilience of the human spirit. That's January 28th at 7 p.m. at the Northwest Film Center in the Witzel Auditorium at 1219 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information on the films and more can be found at cable.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the film screening of Warrior, The Life of Leonard Peltier, Saturday, February 6th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. Warrior tells the true story of Leonard Peltier, the American Indian leader locked away for life in Leavenworth Penitentiary. Warrior takes us back to the violent confrontations at Pine Ridge and Wounded Knee in the 70s, and through Peltier's harrowing odyssey through the American justice system. Leonard's son, Chauncey Peltier, will hold a Q&A after the film. Again, that's Warrior, The Life of Leonard Peltier, Saturday, February 6th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 5:01 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's the KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Of Youth Violence Prevention's Community Peace Collaborative plans a public forum this Friday to analyze a new study on keeping kids out of gangs. The report shows that even one caring adult in a young person's life can keep that youth from getting involved in organized crime. A child development researcher at the University of Illinois surveyed more than 15,700 young people and found almost 1,000 had been asked or pressured to join a gang but did not. A smaller number did join gangs, and Merrin studied why. After digging into all the environmental factors, he reported that kids who refuse gangs reported having one or more supportive adults in their lives. The youth who declined gang membership also were 1.5 times more likely to say they were treated fairly by their teachers and school staff. The study was published in the American Journal of Orthopsychiatry. The Portland Peace Collaborative is where Enough is Enough campaign against street violence is based. The public forum on Merrin's work is at the Community Peace Collaborative public meeting this Friday, January 29, starting at 10 a.m. at the North Portland Precinct Conference Room at Northeast Killingsworth and MLK Boulevard.
Portland police shouldn't assume that deadly force is so inevitable. That was one of the recommendations California-based OIR Group gave in a recent review of 11 Portland police-involved shootings. The consultant specifically wrote about people in extreme emotional distress, especially suicidal individuals, and how officers should not accommodate those who seem intent on provoking violence. The report said that officer-involved shootings are usually unnecessary if officers keep their take cover, keep distance, and respond to the situation more slowly. The review also criticized the way the Portland Police Bureau trains officers that a suspect with a knife within 21 feet of them can attack sooner than the officer can pull and shoot a gun. Experts say that the 21-foot rule should not be seen as a justifiable kill zone, the report said. These 11 reviewed police shootings happened between January 2011 and March 2013, so Police Chief Larry O'Day responded that the Bureau has already made procedure and training improvements since the shootings happened. O'Day also said that the Bureau agrees with most of the report's recommendations. The report will be presented to City Council at 2 p.m. Thursday. O'Day is expected to make comments.
The Supreme Court has, over the years, restricted the ability of states to impose mandatory life sentences without chance of parole for juvenile offenders. Today, the court ruled that this restriction should apply retroactively to juveniles who had already been sentenced to life without parole. KBOO reporter Doug McVeigh spoke with Dan McAleer, executive director of the Center for Juvenile and Criminal Justice, to learn more.
The Supreme Court addressed this issue in a couple other cases, specifically Miller v. Alabama in 2012, where they basically said the states could not pass laws that required judges to sentence 14, 15, and 16-year-olds to spend the rest of their life in prison. Essentially, they must die in prison. The Supreme Court said then that, no, that's not right. What we have to do is allow judges discretion. And so from that point on, what courts across the country were required to do is they could still impose what we call that life without possibility parole, but they had to grant a hearing at some point to see if there has been some substantive change in the person for the sentence to be reconsidered. So, and also, judges had to be given discretion. The legislature could not mandate that judges impose the sentence. They could have the sentence available, but it was at the judge's discretion to impose. So that was in 2012. Now, flash forward to today, Montgomery v. Louisiana. The issue that this one specifically dealt with was whether that 2012 ruling applied to youth who had been sentenced before the Supreme Court rendered its decision in 2012. And there were many people arguing that it shouldn't apply to those people that were sentenced before 2012, and which to me is particularly appalling, frankly. But so the Supreme Court in this case today addressed that, it clarified it and addressed that issue, and they said no, states that are still doing it, requiring those people who were sentenced to, those youth who were sentenced to life without the possibility of parole prior to 2012. The Supreme Court said today, no, states, you have to give them a chance to have their sentences reconsidered at a later date, and the law has to be applied evenly and fairly to everyone. And so that's actually the issue they were addressing today. I think the other piece to that is what a lot of people should be aware of is that this is something that the rest of the civilized world has done long ago. And there's actually a UN charter that all the nations of the world signed on to that says that you will not impose a sentence where a 14, 15, or 16-year-old will be sentenced to die in prison, essentially where they have no chance to ever get out. All the civilized nations of the world with whom we'd like to identify signed that, except for the United States and Somalia. And the reason the United States did not sign that was because of that provision. So I guess we could say the Supreme Court has taken us one step farther into the family of the rest of the civilized world on this issue.
A step closer to the 21st century, too.
Yeah, exactly.
How many states actually do this?
I forget the exact number. There were, for example, states here. I'm here in California. It didn't affect the Miller v. Alabama case. Didn't affect us because even though judges had the right to impose a life sentence without parole, without the possibility of parole, it was at the discretion of the judges. It wasn't a mandatory sentence. And then California passed a law subsequent to that that said that even for those youth who had been sentenced, had received that sentence, they could now have their sentences reconsidered after they had served a certain number of time in prison. And so at least here in California, we've kind of conformed to that. But there were other states, Louisiana being one of them, that resisted it and said that, no, we don't think that we should give anyone a second chance. And that's what the Supreme Court dealt with today.
And just so I have it clear, these are juveniles who are being tried as adults, right?
These were juveniles who were being tried as adults, yes.
Okay, so 14, 15, how young?
Depends on the state. Usually 14. In most states it was 14. 14, 15, 16, 17.
Wow. So now moving forward, what happens?
Well, now the states that were that resisted giving this lifer population a chance at having their sentences reconsidered now are going to have to do that. And so they're going to have to go back and they're going to have to revisit some of these cases. They're going to have to set hearings. And the defendant or the inmate is going to have the chance to offer evidence about their rehabilitation and give the courts a chance to perhaps review and reconsider the sentence. And it'll be for everybody.
Will the inmates, will the people who are serving those sentences now have to, do they have to start the process, or will the state have to begin the process whether or not the person even knows that this is available?
Yeah, that's a good question. So it depends on the state. And generally, so the states, the first step will have to be the states will have to establish a process that allows the case to be revisited. And then at that point, it becomes... often it's incumbent on the individual on the inmate to seek a review or reconsideration.
Dan, any closing thoughts for our listeners, and how do people find out about the work that you're doing at the Center for Juvenile and Criminal Justice?
Well, thank you. Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice, you can visit our website at www.cjcj.org, and we will have some information about today's Supreme Court case up very shortly.
Well, I've been speaking with Dan McAleer. He's the Executive Director of the Center for Juvenile and Criminal Justice based in San Francisco. Dan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Doug.
This is Doug McVeigh with KBOO News.
Portland City Commissioner Steve Novick is set to propose a temporary 10-cent tax on gasoline sold within the city. The tax is expected to raise more than $60 million over a four-year period to be used for street maintenance and improvements. A recent study by the City Club of Portland found that up to 49% of Portland's busiest streets are in need of repair. The total backlog in street maintenance costs is believed to be more than $1 billion. The gas tax would end after 4 years.
A probe launched last year accusing Planned Parenthood of harvesting baby body parts has backfired in Texas, leaving its Republican governor, Greg Abbott, the man who initiated the probe, with egg on his face. No evidence was ever found to back the accusation, and now, on the charge of tampering with those videos, a grand jury in Houston has indicted the two anti-abortion activists whose covert videos created the controversy that brought on the probe. Those videos were designed to show Planned Parenthood attempting to illegally sell fetal tissue. Under federal law, donated human fetal tissue may be used for research, but profiting from its sale is prohibited. David DeLeiden and Sandra Merritt, who shot the videos last year, were indicted by a Harris County grand jury in Houston. The court found there was no wrongdoing on the part of Planned Parenthood, but DeLeiden was charged with violating a prohibition on the purchase and sale of human organs, a misdemeanor. The videos led Texas and several other Republican-controlled states to seek a halt to the funding of local Planned Parenthood operations around the country. Planned Parenthood has denied the accusation and called the Texas probe politically motivated. These people broke the law to spread malicious lies about Planned Parenthood in order to advance their extreme anti-abortion political agenda, said Eric Ferrero, Vice President of Communications for Planned Parenthood Federation of America.
The Supreme Court today refused to hear an appeal by the state of North Dakota regarding that state's extremely restrictive abortion law. This leaves a lower court decision in place, which found that North Dakota's abortion law was unconstitutional. To learn more, KBOO reporter Doug McVeigh spoke with David Brown from the Center for Reproductive Rights.
I'm David Brown, a staff attorney with the Center for Reproductive Rights. This was an attempt by the North Dakota legislature to ban abortion in the state, and obviously that is blatantly unconstitutional under Roe v. Wade. And we at the Center for Reproductive Rights represent Red River Women's Clinic, the only abortion clinic in the state of North Dakota. And we took the case to federal court. We got an injunction, and the state attempted to appeal all the way to the Supreme Court. And today the Supreme Court announced that it would decline to review such a blatantly unconstitutional and extreme anti-abortion law.
Now, they would argue it's not quite a complete ban because it was, what, 6 weeks? After 6 weeks, it becomes criminal?
After 6 weeks from a woman's last menstrual period, so about 4 weeks into the pregnancy, for sort of old-fashioned reasons, pregnancy is dated from 2 weeks before it actually starts. So, yes, there would have been the theoretical possibility, I suppose, of access to abortion in the first couple of weeks of pregnancy. But in practice, most women seek abortion services once they know they're pregnant, and it would have effectively prevented that. Many states, unfortunately, have gotten in the business in recent years of trying to attack women's right to decide for themselves whether to have an abortion, and they do so through a variety of ways. Bureaucratic red tape being a common one, banning abortions with certain methods or for certain reasons. Basically, the idea is to try to be as intrusive and disruptive as possible. But North Dakota's ban was the most extreme in terms of simply banning abortion from almost the very beginning of pregnancy. There was another state recently, Arkansas, that had attempted to ban abortion after about 12 weeks, and that was also struck down in the Supreme Court last week, declined to review it.
So now, with Arkansas and North Dakota, are there any other reproductive rights cases that the court is scheduled to be hearing?
Yes. The Supreme Court is scheduled to hear a case from the state of Texas this month in which Texas has enacted one of these red tape laws, or we call them TRAP, targeted regulation of abortion providers, requiring abortion providers to meet very difficult, expensive, and medically unnecessary standards in order to provide care to women. And that law would effectively close most of the abortion clinics in the state, although not quite all of them. And the Supreme Court is going to hear that case in March, and we expect a decision probably in late June.
I'm curious. The Red River is the only provider in the state of North Dakota. Just for the benefit of listeners, how big is North Dakota? Do you know?
North Dakota has about 700,000 people, and having driven across it, I would say it's about 8 hours from end to end. I'm not quite sure how far that is in miles. It's a big state, yes, and it's a very rural state, and so obviously, women seeking abortion care in North Dakota already have to drive a long way, and so had the state truly banned abortion altogether, it would have been, an even bigger blow for women who are already in a difficult situation.
So now, David, any closing thoughts for our listeners, and where can people find out about the work that the center is doing?
Well, just to close, we're very pleased at today's results, and we're very pleased to know that the Supreme Court is remaining firm in upholding now nearly 50 years of its decisions protecting a woman's constitutional right to decide for herself whether to have an abortion. And people can learn more at the website for the Center for Reproductive Rights, which is www.reprorights.org.
Terrific. Well, I've been speaking with David Brown. He's a staff attorney for the Center for Reproductive Rights. They're on the web at reprorights.org. The Supreme Court today decided not to hear an appeal from the state of North Dakota on its anti-abortion law that essentially outlawed abortions. David, I thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
This is Doug McVeigh with KBOO News.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with KBOO's Paul Rowland about the ongoing occupation of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge. This will be followed by Labor Radio at 6, featuring a live interview with Mike Adara of the Rural Organizing Project on what militia incursions mean for working people in rural Oregon and elsewhere. Then at 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Host Karen James interviews Marie Levin from the Prisoner Hunger Strike Solidarity Coalition and California Families Against Solitary Confinement. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather, increasing clouds with a low around 41. Tomorrow, rain likely, cloudy with a high near 51. Chance of precipitation is 60%. Today in history, in 1890, the United Mine Workers of America was founded in Columbus, Ohio. And in 2011, protests began in Egypt against poverty, unemployment, and government corruption. The protests spread from Tahrir Square in Cairo to the rest of Egypt, eventually leading to the resignation of President Hosni Mubarak. The quote of the day is from John L. Lewis, president of the United Mine Workers of America for 4 decades and the founding president of the Congress of Industrial Organizations, who said, "No tin hat brigade of goose-stepping vigilantes or Bible-babbling mob of blackguarding and corporation-paid scoundrels will prevent the onward march of labor or divert its purpose to play its natural and rational part in the development of the economic, political, and social life of our nation."
It's 5:21, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Ready or not, it's time to go cruising again. I realize that it can be frightening to travel through the dark, dangerous corridors of Ted Cruz's mind, making stomach-turning hard right turns that suddenly appear without warning. Yet, we must, for this guy intends to be your president. But buckle up, for this trip not only takes us into Ted's mind, but also into the twisting mental curves of his hero, role model, mentor, top advisor, and surrogate campaigner, Rafael Cruz, also known as Daddy. Ted is campaigning as a truth-teller and an honest fighter for freedom, regularly using his father's life story as a guidepost to his own integrity. The candidate tells and retells the story that his father first told him as a boy, about how Daddy Cruz had been a courageous rebel leader in Fidel Castro's Cuban Revolution in the 1950s. Rafael says he ran guns, threw Molotov cocktails, and even survived arrest and torture in the struggle to bring down the right-wing dictatorship of Fulgencio Batista. It's a riveting bit of history that thrills Senator Cruz's audiences and gives emotional power to his political ambition. Indeed, Rafael's Cuban heroics are so inspiring that son Ted features them in his recent campaign book, pointedly titled A Time for Truth. But look out. Here's where the high moral road of Rafael's story suddenly washes out, sending his and Ted's integrity spinning off into a deep political ravine. It turns out that practically none of the tales about the father's machismo actions in Cuba actually happened. This is Jim Hightower saying, only a handful of real freedom fighters of that time remember Rafael at all. And none of them recall him doing anything more than strutting around and talking big. In fact, he was known as an ojalatero, one who wished the dictator would fall, but was too squeamish to act on it.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at LaborRadio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. With a week to go in the Iowa caucus, the balance in the Democratic race appears to have shifted. Poll after poll has shown Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders closing the gap between him and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. WIN's Greta Anderson has more from Iowa.
Most unions are backing Clinton and are working hard on caucus turnout. But unions like CWA and the United Postal Workers, which have endorsed Bernie, are also getting out the labor vote. Some unions, like the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, have chosen not to endorse a candidate yet. Mike Olson serves as registrar for IBEW Local 405 in Cedar Rapids. He notes that among his members,
those that take the time to keep up on things, Bernie Sanders seems to be getting their support.
Of course, non-unionized workers will have their say on February 1st as well. Terry Davis of Ames combines two jobs as a grocery store worker and an independent contractor delivering papers. He says Clinton is his choice today, but that he may move to Sanders by caucus night. His reason has everything to do with workers' wages.
One of the biggest issues in this country is the income disparity, and that's pretty much a bullseye issue for him.
But for Bernie's surge to translate into a win, those target voters will have to show up at 7 p.m. next Monday night. Greta Anderson, Ames, Iowa, Workers Independent News.
This is Mitch Lawrence with the Sports Minute for Workers Independent News. Slowly but surely, we've had a changing of the guard in the National Basketball Association. The face of the league is no longer LeBron James, who has been the top player in the world for the better part of the last decade. James is in plenty of TV commercials, and his Cleveland Cavaliers are still the team to beat in the East. But now the face of the NBA belongs to another player who was also born in Akron, Ohio. Golden State's Stephen Curry has passed LeBron in jersey sales, which is always a significant measure of an NBA player's popularity. Just 27 and 4 years younger than James, Curry was voted the league's most valuable player last season, while leading the Warriors to their first title since 1975. This season, even as his coach Steve Kerr has been sidelined by a back problem, Kerr still has the Warriors winning games at a record pace. With more than half the season in the books, the Warriors are on a pace to win 74 games, which would surpass the 72 games won by the Chicago Bulls back when Michael Jordan played. That record was set exactly 20 years ago. Now much of the attention is on Curry as he tries to lead his team to the record and back-to-back titles. And with Curry's number 30 flying off the racks, the argument can be made that now he has surpassed James, who has gone by the nickname The King ever since he arrived in the NBA. Don't look now, LeBron, but your reign is over. With the Sports Minute for Workers Independent News, this is Mitch Lawrence.
WIN is made possible in part by the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Under health care reform, starting this year, businesses with 50 or more employees have to offer health insurance to full-time staff. Some fast food franchise owners figure out a way to avoid paying for coverage. Make everyone part-time. The California Report has the story.
We are breaking format today to go on a field trip, and I'm standing in a McDonald's in Northern California with the California Report's health reporter, April Domboski. So, April, why'd you bring me here?
To get some French fries? No, I'm just kidding. It's restaurants like these where the latest drama of the Affordable Care Act is playing out. So a new part of the law kicks in this year that requires employers to offer their workers health insurance.
I thought Obamacare already required that.
Well, so starting last year, employers that had more than 100 full-time workers had to offer insurance. But this year, it's smaller businesses with 50 to 99 employees that have to comply. So that means a lot of franchise businesses or small chains like retail stores and restaurants that now have to offer coverage to their full-time employees.
And how is full-time being defined?
Well, the Affordable Care Act defines it as 30 hours a week or more, not 40 like most of us think of it.
And that number's key to the story you're going to tell us about how some fast food restaurants in California are trying to find a way around this new health law.
Exactly. So to explain that, I'm going to take you next to a Burger King in the Central Valley. A few cars idle in line at this drive-thru off Highway 99.
Excuse me, Burger King, go ahead and order when you're ready.
Inside, half a dozen workers in black uniforms scurry around, grabbing packets of ketchup, stuffing burgers into paper bags.
Number 22.
Two barbecues, two ketchup.
Tiana Mua has worked here almost a year.
I'm part-time.
She'd like to be full-time,
because I want to become independent.
But at this Burger King, only the managers are full-time. Mua says it's like that at fast food joints all over town. It's hard to get more than 30 hours.
They're cutting back on all jobs, and like a lot of people have been like let go and everything already.
One reason is the local economy is bad. People aren't eating out as much, and sales are down. But there's another reason that might explain why fast food employees aren't getting more hours. Obamacare. Starting this year, businesses with 50 or more employees have to offer health insurance to full-time staff. Some fast food restaurant owners figured out a way to avoid paying for coverage. Just make everyone part-time. Nearly 60% of small franchise businesses said they would do this.
The ones that did it successfully did it 3-4 years ago.
Kaya Bromley is an attorney helping employers comply with the Affordable Care Act.
But here's an interesting thing that I've seen in my actual practice.
Bromley says some of those restaurant owners who cut hours to sidestep the health law now regret it.
A lot of the fast food franchisees that did this are now coming back and saying it was a great idea for reducing the number of people that I have to offer benefits, but now I can't run my restaurants.
They tell her it's been a nightmare trying to manage a part-time staff.
Because you've got people who are less loyal, you've got people who are less skilled, who don't understand the business, and there's more turnover.
So Bromley has seen a lot of those restaurants reverse course.
Employers think that there's a shortcut here or there, and then they realize, yeah, that shortcut really, you know, hurt me more than it helped me.
Large fries, but a small drink. You got no bacon on the burger, right?
At the Carl's Jr. in Chowchilla, full-time employees are offered health insurance. In fact, manager Sylvia Campos tries to keep as many workers full-time as possible. She says it makes her job easier.
It's a small town. It's really, for me, it's hard to find that really good employees. We have employees, and then for one reason, they don't like it and go. So it is really hard to keep with the people.
But Campos says some workers don't want more hours. They get subsidized or free coverage through Medi-Cal. If their income gets too high, they lose the public benefits.
We're trying, but sometimes they don't want it the full time. Someone say, no, keep me on the part time, and that's good with me. Just because other insurance, they you don't have to make it that much money for qualifying.
The company insurance costs $300 a month. Some workers say they're better off making less money and getting their coverage free from the state.
No, that's it. Thank you.
For the California Report, I'm April Demboski.
Canada's international trade minister said Monday that Ottawa intends to sign the Trans-Pacific Partnership, but that does not mean the federal government will ratify the massive trade deal. In a statement, Chrystia Freeland said, "Just as it is too soon to endorse the TPP, it's also too soon to close the door." But that's exactly what protesters in countries bordering the Pacific Ocean are calling for. Demonstrations against the TPP are growing as leaders of 12 Pacific Rim nations, including the U.S., are poised to sign the deal next week. Once signed, the agreement must be signed by all 12 member nations. Joshua Tucker brings us more from Santiago, Chile.
As the 12 TPP member nations make plans to sign the trade agreement at a ceremony next week in New Zealand, protesters marched in 11 cities spanning the length of Chile over the weekend. The massive trade deal was hammered out during 5 years of secret negotiations and will tie together 40% of the world's economy. Supporters of the deal tout its protections for intellectual property rights, its reduction of trade tariffs, and its provisions providing legal recourse for companies who find their profits threatened by the laws of member nations. Opponents of the TPP say it's a threat to jobs and wages, safe food, and affordable medicine. They also caution that the dispute settlement system in the deal give corporations and investors an end run around the sovereign right of nations to govern their own affairs. Claudio Escobar Cáceres, a math professor, spoke as the march began.
What's going to happen is that on February 4th, the president will sign this treaty with all the other member nations, and Congress will ratify in March. Once the president signs, it's taken as is. Congress can't change any of its contents in terms of anything, be it food sovereignty, territorial sovereignty, intellectual property rights, protection for seeds.
Legislators and the public got their first glimpse of the thousands of pages that make up the trade agreement in disclosures made by WikiLeaks. The full text was not officially made public until early November. Last summer, lawmakers in the U.S. granted President Obama fast-track authority on the deal. But if the intense debate on that issue is any indication, an up or down congressional vote on the final agreement could be contentious. The trade agreement must be ratified by the Congress of each of the 12 member nations to take effect. Meanwhile, protests are spreading in other countries, including Malaysia and Peru, two of the poorest countries included in the trade agreement. Here in Chile, anti-TPP protesters say they will march again on February 4th, the day leaders plan to sign the trade agreement. And they vow to continue their protests in March, when the Chilean Congress is set to vote on ratifying the trade agreement. Joshua Tucker, FSRN, Santiago.
Thousands of protesters marched against the Haitian government after presidential elections scheduled for Sunday were indefinitely postponed. The elections were canceled when the main opposition party candidate withdrew from the elections, claiming voter fraud. Under the Haitian constitution, the current president is required to leave office on February 7th, but has now indicated he may remain in office. International leaders are asking Haiti to form an interim government to conduct elections in the near future, fearing a civil war may break out if elections are not held within the next few months.
An unarmed United Nations peace mission to oversee a Colombian ceasefire has been approved by the Security Council, pending the signing of a peace accord between left-wing FARC rebels and the government. Rebel and government negotiators last week requested the UN involvement. Working in Cuba over the past 3 years to come up with an agreement, negotiators appear to be very close to finally obtaining it. The war has been going on for decades and has left 200,000 dead. While the two sides have reached agreement on such key issues as future political participation of rebels, land rights, drug trafficking, and transitional justice, details remain to be ironed out on removal of landmines, reintegrating guerrillas into the general population, and other details. The UN mission will consist of observers from Latin American and Caribbean nations.
Art by the internationally famous but anonymous graffiti artist Banksy appeared over the weekend on the French embassy in London. The stenciled painting shows the girl from Les Miserables with a canister of tear gas at her feet. The image includes a QR code linking to a video of French police tear gassing refugees from Africa living in camps in the French town of Calais. Earlier this month, Banksy also painted several hard-hitting graffiti images around the port town of Calais and on the walls of the refugee camp known as the Jungle. One of Banksy's images depicts Steve Jobs, who is the son of Syrian immigrants. The image has been defaced by vandals. French officials have tear-gassed and tried to bulldoze the camp repeatedly. An estimated 1,500 people live there, including an unknown number of Syrian refugees.
United Nations-sponsored peace talks on the Syrian civil war are set to begin later this week in Geneva. Russia, Iran, Iraq, Lebanon, and Syria are on one side, with Saudi Arabia, Israel, Turkey, and the Western NATO powers on the other. The Syrian civil war has lasted almost 5 years and has resulted in more than 350,000 deaths, causing almost half of the country's 22 million citizens to become refugees. Since entering the Syrian conflict late last year, Russia has continued to conduct more than 50 bombing runs per day in support of the Syrian army, allowing the Syrian army to recapture more than 30 cities in Syria previously controlled by the Daesh terrorist organization. In related news, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has taken the first steps to introduce fast-track legislation to provide the president with expanded war-making powers. The new legislation would increase the president's ability to conduct open-ended military operations without the consent of Congress. The legislation would not be bound by geography or duration and would permit the president to deploy U.S. ground troops in combat situations without having to seek congressional approval.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Monday, January 25th, 2016. Two youth killed in the West Bank by Israeli army gunfire and jet fighters target areas in Gaza. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Two Palestinian youth were killed on Monday evening by Israeli army gunfire near the central West Bank city of Ramallah. Palestinian sources said that the two killed Palestinians are Ibrahim Allan, 23, from the village of Beit Ur al-Tahta near Ramallah, and Hassan Abu Ghosh, 17, from the Kalandi refugee camp in Ramallah. The Israeli army said that the two entered the illegal Israeli settlement of Beit Huran near Ramallah city and tried to stab settlers before they were shot by soldiers. According to the Palestinian Ministry of Health, at least 162 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli gunfire since October 1, 2015. On Monday at dawn, Israeli soldiers invaded several districts in the occupied West Bank, searched many homes and kidnapped at least 10 Palestinians. Invasions and home searches and kidnappings were reported in Bethlehem, Hebron, Jerusalem and Jenin. Elsewhere, Israeli warjets fired on Monday at dawn several missiles targeting two areas in the Gaza Strip, causing damage. Palestinian sources in Gaza said that the Israeli bombardment caused property damage but did not lead to any casualties. They added that the Air Force fired a missile into an open land in the location of a former settlement south of Khan Yunis in the southern part of the Gaza Strip. In addition, the Israeli Air Force also fired a missile into an area south of Deir al-Balah in central Gaza, causing excessive property damage and anxiety attacks among the residents. The Israeli attack comes shortly after a shell was fired from Gaza on Sunday evening, landed in open area in the Sha'ar Hanegev Regional Council of Settlements, causing no damage or injuries. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, January 25th, 2016, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Banoura.
You're listening to the KVU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Martin Dodge, Joanna Peterson, Demi Hellenius, Don Zare, and Ken Jones. The producer is Doug McVeigh. Special thanks to Paul Rowland. Our engineer is Mike Fotoklis. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kate Brown's number is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Joanna Peterson. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With journalists Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Abe Proctor and Joe Uris host the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. At 9, on Alternative Radio, David Zirin, sports editor for The Nation magazine, speaks on racism, resistance, and black athletes. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, hear Stage and Studio, a weekly live show featuring best of performing, literary, and media arts in Portland and beyond. And at 11:30, Andre Middleton hosts Art Focus, interviews with artists, curators, critics, and other art people. Thanks for listening to KBOO Community Radio, and thanks, members, for your support. If you are not a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
And stay tuned now for an interview with KBOO's Paul Rowland about the ongoing occupation of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge. Good night, Joanna.
Good night, Ken. Good night, Mike.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
The occupation of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge in Harney County by an armed group of self-styled militiamen from out of state is now entering its fourth week. A community meeting to discuss the occupation, scheduled for today in Burns, was canceled by Harney County Judge Steve Grasty. Judge Grasty cited safety concerns as the primary reason for the cancellation. KBOO's Paul Rowland is on the ground in Burns, and I spoke with Paul to get more information on what's been going on in Harney County. Paul, you talked with Harney County Judge Steve Grasty today. He canceled a community meeting that was scheduled. What's the reason for the cancellation?
Yes, he released a statement that was at the county courthouse where we just were, and said, it is with a heavy heart that I feel the need to cancel the community event scheduled for January 25th. Preparations to protest and block entrances to the senior center have led me to determine that it's time to take a time out. Cancellation of this meeting seems prudent in order to maintain the safety of our community and everyone in it, and because an open and honest conversation cannot take place in this type of atmosphere. Further, I will not give these agitators what they want most, which is attention. One paragraph from the statement he released today.
What were the safety concerns? The meeting is supposed to be no guns allowed, right?
The concerns were there was threats to actually physically block